This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Hello, I'm James Kamara-Sami. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Wednesday, the 22nd of January. As the Defence Secretary reveals, he authorised a Royal Navy submarine to surface near a suspicious Russian ship loitering near the UK's critical undersea infrastructure. We ask his Conservative predecessor, Grant Shapps, about the maritime threat from Moscow and about Donald Trump's threat to impose more economic sanctions on Russia if President Putin doesn't strike a deal with Ukraine. Also tonight, we report on a major Israeli military operation in the West Bank. Consider the legal lessons of Prince Harry's settlement with the news group Newspapers. Hear about the chaos in the Irish Parliament and why the cliché of the stupid footballer is wide of the goalpost. We see you. We know what you're doing. That, according to the Defence Secretary, is the message that Britain has sent to President Putin. Speaking in the Commons today, John Healey said he had changed the Royal Navy's rules of engagement to allow British warships to move closer to and to track a Russian vessel that has become suspiciously Anglophile. The Russians say that the Yantar is a research vessel, but Britain believes it is a spy ship. It was in UK waters this week, but it was also in the vicinity in November. And Mr. Healey told MPs today that he had taken an unusual decision after the ship was spotted loitering over critical undersea infrastructure.
I authorised a Royal Navy submarine, strictly as a deterrent measure, to surface close to Yantar to make clear that we had been covertly monitoring its every move. The ship then left UK waters without further loitering and sailed down to the Mediterranean.
This follows recent suspicions that Russia's so-called shadow fleet, aging oil tankers being used to evade sanctions, could have been deployed to damage undersea power and telecommunications cables in the Baltic Sea. Concerns about Russia's maritime activity aren't new, of course, but they have been heightened since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And in April 2023, Danish journalists filmed a Russian research ship that was suspected of sabotaging wind farms and communications cables in the North Sea.
We're filming everything on the ship. We're filming antennas. I can see crew members walking around on the deck. I think they're watching us. Wow, they're looking at us. This is really a strange situation. Almost a tense situation. They're looking at us.
Well, Shashank Joshi is defence editor of The Economist. He told me what we know about the ship called the Yantar that's been spotted around UK waters.
Essentially, the Yantar is a spy ship. It looks at things underwater to map out things like where the seabed goes, what might be lying on the surface, things like pipelines, cables, other kinds of maritime infrastructure. It almost certainly has the capacity to gather other kinds of intelligence, such as maybe the noises it can hear, nearby ships. Perhaps it can gather radio frequency emissions, communications from things that might be of interest nearby, like other naval vessels. But long and short of it is, it's gathering intelligence of different sorts. And in this particular case, it seems to be gathering intelligence around undersea infrastructure of the sort that has been under heightened risk in the last year or so.
Yes, and there have, of course, been cables cut in some parts of the world. Is it something that a ship like this would be doing?
No, probably not. These ships are under real scrutiny. These ships are probably doing reconnaissance on where those cables are running, exactly where they're placed, how well protected are they, and that information information can then be used in other ways to actually cut the cables or do other kinds of harm to them or to other infrastructure. So if you look at the recent cases in the Baltic Sea, quite far from us in the UK, those cables appear to have been damaged by tankers. In the most recent case, part of a Russian shadow fleet ship called the Eagle S, using its anchor dragged along the seabed. Now, there is a debate as to whether that was accidental or deliberate, but the point is, the spy ship is too obvious a culprit. It's really gathering intelligence for use by someone else or something else.
And what of the British response to this?
It's been quite punchy. This is the second time the Yantar's been in UK waters. And we must be really careful here. When I say UK waters, I don't mean territorial waters, which is 12 nautical miles from the shore. I mean the UK's exclusive economic zone, which is a little bit different. It's not part of your national sovereign waters in the same way. And the UK has been shadowing this very carefully using warships, using maritime patrol aircraft. And also the most notable thing is that we saw the Defence Secretary say he authorised a submarine to surface near the ship to show its presence as a deterrent, to say, look, we're watching you, we know what you're doing, we know where you are. That's a pretty unusual step. Submarines are normally very stealthy. They're designed to avoid detection, avoid showing their hand. So this is an unusual step that I think shows the level of concern around Russian mapping of maritime infrastructure in UK waters.
Concern because the cables are at risk, and what exactly are the cables we're talking about?
Well, we're talking really about a few different sorts of things. One of them is pipelines. The other one is data cables that carry the vast majority of internet traffic around the world, well over 95%. And we're also talking, in some cases in European waters, of electricity cables. And so all of these things are seen to be at risk. In the most recent cases, the threat has been to pipelines. The Nord Stream pipeline carrying gas to and from Germany was blown up about 2 years ago, and the suspicion has fallen on Ukraine for that, not Russia. And in the other cases, in the Baltic, but also, by the way, this week in the waters around one of Taiwan's islands called Matsu, it is data cables that were cut, causing a potential loss of communications. And that's a real source of concern when you think how much of our day-to-day digital life, including things like the stock exchange and critical services, depend on quick and reliable access to those data cables.
So do we know what Russia's ambitions might be?
I think there's two concerns. One of them is that Russia is mapping and monitoring these cables and other infrastructure to pose a potential threat to them in wartime. That is, if a war broke out between NATO and Russia, there would be an incentive for Russia to disrupt military communications and civilian life. But the more immediate and pressing concern is that we have seen a number of acts of Russian, what is sometimes called hybrid warfare, including sabotage, subversion, assassination across Europe in peacetime to try and frighten the West, dissuade it from supporting Ukraine, persuading it to back away from the conflict in Ukraine. And the concern is Russia could take these steps now, as it may have done in other parts of the region, even before a war has broken out. So this is to deter them from taking any such step.
Shashank Joshi of The Economist. Well, President Trump waded into Russian diplomatic waters today. He used a post on his Truth Social platform to talk of his love of Russia and his good relationship with President Putin before going on to call on the Russian leader to settle now and stop this ridiculous war. After an all caps, it's only going to get worse. There is a threat. If we don't make a deal soon, he writes, I have no choice but to put high levels of taxes, tariffs and sanctions on anything being sold by Russia to the United States. Well, I've been discussing President Trump's moves on Ukraine and Russia with the former Conservative Defence Secretary Grant Shapps. But we began with his Labour successor's response to what he called the Russian spy ship. So was it the right one?
I actually think John Healey's done exactly the right thing here. It is the case that Russia isn't like another nation who, you know, normally the professionalism of navies causes them to ensure that they are more than adhering to the international rules that are in place. Unfortunately, instructed by Putin, that isn't what happens with the Russian Navy. So this is behavior that we've seen many times before. And actually, it therefore requires a somewhat more stand-up response to it.
Should we be prepared, though, to go further? I mean, this was a reconnaissance spy vessel, it's understood. But there have been incidents where Russian-linked oil tankers are thought to have actually tampered with cables undersea in recent months. I mean, if there was something like that, would we be justified in going beyond what has happened now, actually boarding a ship?
Yes, I think we do have to take a more upfront approach. We know that both Russian and, I'm afraid, sometimes Chinese ships have been accused of this as well, are not always playing by the international rules of the sea. And if you do nothing, then it's tempting for them to carry on. There's some very good examples of things that you can do, including boarding a ship if you suspect that it is up to no good. And I actually think we should impound these ships as well in different circumstances to do with aircraft and yachts. After Putin invaded Russia, we impounded them. They still remain impounded to this day. I think actually the same thing should happen if a ship is suspected of, then you're perfectly at liberty to go and investigate that. And sometimes that means you might have to detain the ship for a period of time in order to get to the truth.
Even one of these spy ships?
Well, we know, as you say, you're right, you called it a spy ship. We all know what they're up to. And you do therefore have to have a more proactive, forward-leaning stance towards it. They're sailing through international waters, but they're sailing within waters within our economic zone. And so the rules are that you don't hang around, that you do pass through. And it's important that every country respects that with their vessels.
You mention economic matters. That turns us to the new president of the United States, who has today threatened more economic sanctions against Russia if it doesn't come to the table and hold discussions about ending the war in Ukraine. Do you think that is a useful rhetorical gesture?
Yes, I was pleased to see it. I very strongly welcome what he said today. And what he wrote was important in a number of ways. I think actually those of us who really strongly believe that the success of Ukraine is in the outcome of this war, that a lack of US leadership might lead to a different conclusion. And I think that was the concern that a lot of people are expressing. It's what people said whilst I was defense secretary. How worried are you? I think actually the statement today is incredibly important because it actually says not only President Putin is this unacceptable and you must end it, but also we're going to encourage other countries to join us in further measures if you don't bring this to a close.
And he wants to make a deal. I mean, that deal will presumably involve Ukraine having to cede some of its territory. President Zelensky has more than hinted that he realizes he's not going to get everything he wants. Is that acceptable, do you think?
Well, look, I think the absolute key thing here is that an aggressor nation doesn't in the end feel that the cost of the aggression was worthwhile. Now, I accept that, you know, whether every single inch of territory or the rest of it, that is an issue for the Ukrainians. And as you say, Zelensky has spoken about it. I've spoken to Zelensky about it. That is their decision to make. What I don't want to see is us imposing a solution on Ukraine.
I mean, you said in May we should stand behind them fully in order to eject Russia from all of their territory. But you accept now,
yes,
that if they're accepting that's not possible, then what we should go along with it.
Look, there is massive cost to Ukraine in all of this and being constantly at war. We're coming up to the third year. I think my message to Ukraine, and it's something that I'll say to Zelensky directly, is you should come to the conclusions yourself about what a settlement should look like. What I think matters to the rest of the world is that it is absolutely clear that the aggressor, Putin in this case, has not overall benefited. So even if there was a settlement which involved land, he will have lost, at the moment, between 1,000 and 1,500 people a day. But he's also lost the ability to pretend that the Red Army, the Russian bear, is as powerful as we all assumed it was.
I just want to come back to the sort of deal and what Ukraine might expect. I mean, this was Donald Trump's national security advisor, Mike Waltz. I just don't think it's realistic to say that we're going to expel every Russian off every inch of Ukrainian soil, even from Crimea. President Trump has acknowledged this reality. So I mean, that is what America is saying publicly, the new Trump administration, that they don't think that Ukraine is going to get all of its territory back. And if it doesn't, surely that has implications beyond Ukraine, even if it's Ukraine's choice whether or not that's the sort of deal it wants to sign up to. That has implications for us, for everyone in Europe, because it will mean that Russia has managed to acquire territory through aggression.
Yes. And look, I don't like that one bit. And in the ideal world, you'd never give an inch of territory. I absolutely agree. And I would stand by, personally, I would stand by Ukraine if that is then in the end their decision, that they won't. But having said that, as I point out, if the cost of gaining an inch of territory has been so horrendous that what it's done has shown Russia up to be this weak power means that it would still have the impact of potentially dissuading somebody else from following an aggressive approach elsewhere in the world.
The former Defence Secretary, Grant Shapps. The ceasefire in Gaza may be holding, but the focus has now switched to the West Bank, where Israel says it is carrying out a powerful and large-scale military operation in the Palestinian city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank in order, it says, to eliminate terrorism there. It comes as President Trump this week lifted sanctions on Israeli settlers who attacked Palestinian villages in the West Bank. And that's fueled that speculation that his administration may be prepared to give the Israeli government much greater leeway there. At the World Economic Forum in Davos in Switzerland, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said a permanent ceasefire in Gaza could lead to serious political negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. But he also warned of another possibility.
The other possibility is for Israel, feeling emboldened by the military successes that it has had, to think that this is the moment to do the annexation of the West Bank. It is clear for me that Israel is not fundamentally interested in Gaza, it's fundamentally interested in the West Bank.
Well, the Palestinian Ministry of Health says that 10 people have been killed and 50 have been injured in the current West Bank operation. Israeli army vehicles are controlling the entry of medical staff and ambulances to the main hospital and have blocked access to the Jenin refugee camp that's home to both civilians and armed Palestinian groups. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson sent this report from Jenin.
Tonight, on the outskirts of Jenin, a fresh battle between Israeli forces and Palestinian gunmen. This operation, described as large-scale and powerful by Israel's leaders, is now ending its second day, with soldiers controlling the entrance to Jenin's main hospital and many families trying to leave the refugee camp where armed groups are based. One man who left the camp today said residents were being separated by the army into groups of five and remotely checked by a military drone before being either arrested or allowed to leave. All the main roads into Jenin refugee camp have been closed off by the Israeli army. So we've come here to this smaller back road to try and see if we can get in. But the road into the camp has been completely churned up by the army bulldozers. And I can see at the end there are some Israeli army vehicles and some soldiers. And at least one of them has raised his weapon. It's not clear whether he's trying to get a better look at us or whether we just need to leave. As we were moving away, we spotted a family picking their way through the tangle of earth and concrete, one man lifting his infant son high above his head as he approached.
There are still a lot of people inside, elderly people, patients, kids. They couldn't leave. They're still inside. God help them. It's not normal for us this time. The strikes come everywhere. It's like Gaza.
Leaving with him, 52-year-old Kefa Sewal. I've lost 15 members of my family since the Gaza war began, she said. After what happened to Israel in Gaza, this is their reaction. They're taking it out on us. Israel's army shared footage of its troops detonating explosives and carrying out searches in the camp. Israel has carried out regular raids here since the 7th of October attacks to arrest suspects from armed Palestinian groups. But Israel's defense minister has talked about a shift in strategy for this operation. The goal not only to eliminate terrorists, as he put it, but prevent them from returning later. A key lesson from Gaza, he said. Israel is worried about the West Bank becoming the next focus for Iranian influence and arms. But a show of force here, after the ceasefire in Gaza, also plays well with those in Israel, who not only want to continue the war there, but want to annex the West Bank as well.
And that report was by Lucy Williamson. A quick reminder, if you want to listen back to any of this programme or to previous ones, you can go to BBC Sounds, where you can also download the podcast. Our main headline so far on The World Tonight, the publisher of The Sun newspaper has agreed to pay substantial damages to Prince Harry as part of a settlement following a five-year legal battle.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo.
Und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Now, the process to install a new Irish Prime Minister descended into chaos this afternoon after members of the opposition shouted down an attempt by government parties to nominate Micheál Martin. Mr. Martin has called it a subversion of the Irish Constitution. Let's get more on this from our Ireland correspondent, Chris Page. Chris, this was supposed to be a formality, wasn't it? What happened?
Yeah, it was supposed to be a day of ceremony here in Dublin, Jimmy, but instead it'll be remembered for acrimony. Micheál Martin, the leader of Fianna Fáil, was due to be officially installed as the Prime Minister of Ireland, the Taoiseach. It would have been a second stint in the job. This is an outcome of coalition negotiations since the general election in November, in which the centre-right parties Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael were returned to power. But they're going to have to navigate some pretty tricky domestic headwinds before they actually get to take office again. The dispute which broke out in the chamber of the Irish Parliament, the Dáil, was about the status of independent members of Parliament here actually supporting the government. There's been a move to also allow them to sit the opposition benches. The opposition parties, led by Sinn Féin, have said, no, that's not on. You've either got to be in government or in opposition. You can't be both. So the Dáil proceedings were adjourned twice within the space of an hour whenever things just descended into unworkable rowdiness. There were negotiations between the parties. About 4 o'clock, they all went back into the chamber. The government said there'd been an agreement to move forward with the nomination of Micheál Martin as Taoiseach. They went into that process, but the opposition rose to their feet, shouted things like outrageous, disgraceful, and then the Speaker, Verona Murphy, said she had no option but to adjourn proceedings until tomorrow morning. So no Speaker election today. Something of a national embarrassment, many observers are saying.
And tomorrow then, what can we expect? Oh, perhaps it's not the time for predictions.
Officially, the politicians will be back in the chamber at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. But the Speaker, known as the Cathain Comhairle, has convened a meeting of senior politicians tonight to try to resolve this impasse. No sign of a breakthrough. It could well go on until the early hours of the morning. No one's really betting on Micheál Martin ascending to the Taoiseach's office tomorrow either. So at the moment, the future of politics in Ireland really clouded in some uncertainty. The coalition government had said in its programme for government, its coalition agreement, it was well placed to deal with international headwinds, but it looks like it's going to have to deal with some turbulence closer to home first.
Chris, many thanks. Our Ireland correspondent Chris Page in Dublin. The publisher of the Sun newspaper has agreed to pay substantial damages and apologise to the Duke of Sussex, Prince Harry, to settle a long-running legal battle over claims of unlawful intrusion into his life. News Group Newspapers admitted that incidents of unlawful activity were carried out by private investigators working for the newspaper in a statement read out in court. They said there was no voicemail interception at the Sun. The BBC understands the settlements to both Prince Harry and the former Labour deputy leader, Lord Tom Watson, have cost NGN more than £10 million in payouts and legal fees. This all follows a long-running series of court cases that sprang from the revelation back in 2011 that the phone of the murdered schoolgirl Millie Dowler had been hacked by journalists from the News of the World. In July of that year, the Prime Minister David Cameron gave this response.
We do need to have an inquiry, possibly inquiries, into what has happened. Let us be clear, we are no longer talking here about politicians and celebrities. We're talking about murder victims, potentially terrorist victims, having their phones hacked into. It is absolutely disgusting.
That led to the launch of the Leveson Inquiry into the culture, practice and ethics of the press. Well, that same month, Rupert Murdoch and his son James appeared in front of a committee of MPs, among them Tom Watson, about the closure of the News of the World.
Our understanding was, which I believe was around the closure of the News of the World newspaper.
Before you get to that, I would just like to say one sentence. This is the most humble day of my life.
In a separate court case in 2023, Prince Harry settled hacking claims against a different media company, Mirror Group Newspapers. Last year, he told the broadcaster ITV that his action was a personal fight for justice.
This is a David versus Goliath situation. The Davids are the claimants, and the Goliath is this vast media enterprise. I'm trying to get justice for everybody.
I've been discussing the implications of today's settlement with Clive Coleman. He's currently a senior partner at Maltin PR, but was formerly the BBC's legal affairs correspondent, and he covered the hacking cases from the beginning.
Prince Harry has won a resounding victory because the admission today that there was unlawful news gathering activity at The Sun has been one that The Sun and the Murdoch Empire has been at great pains to say simply wasn't the case. So I think that was a critical element in Prince Harry settling this case. He was really the last man standing together with Lord Watson. There have been something like 1,300 claims in relation to the News of the World and The Sun, and they have all been settled. And they've been settled because of a mechanism known as the Part 36 offer. It used to be called a payment into court. And it was designed to settle cases. And what it does is it allows the defendants to make an offer to the claimant that, if it is really well judged, will exceed the amount of damages that they're likely to recover in the case itself. So it's almost an offer you can't refuse, because if the claimant doesn't beat the Part 36 offer, then they are liable for the costs of both sides from, I think it's 21 days after the offer is made. And that puts an incredibly high amount of pressure on them, a burden on them. Hugh Grant, we saw, accepted a Part 36 offer. And the reason is that the amount of damages you can recover in a breach of privacy case, which effectively is what all of these cases are, is in the tens, thousands, maybe some have been above six figures, I think, but they are dwarfed by the legal costs, which run into millions. And so they really are an offer that you can't refuse. But Prince Harry had decided that he was going to refuse it. And I think it was only today, when he got this admission in relation to unlawful news gathering at The Sun, that he felt that he had made his point. He had won the battle to show that actually this unlawful news gathering was widespread. It wasn't just at the News of the World. It was at The Sun as well. And something like 35,000 instructions to private investigators being used. So these are extraordinary numbers.
There will be relief, won't there, at News Group, that this hasn't gone to court?
Well, I think there'll be relief that this is now effectively over. This raft of litigation that has been going on for more than a decade, it's extraordinary. I mean, I was covering it at the BBC when it started, and there was a joke doing the rounds that there are two types of lawyer in London: those who've been instructed by News International, as it then was, and those who are about to be instructed by News International. So for the lawyers, this has been an extraordinary gravy train, actually.
And so they are the winners, are they?
They are. It was sort of the cash machine that kept on paying. But as far as what started off as News International, News UK, News Group newspapers, this really is the end of a very, very long story that has cost them well over $1 billion.
Although Tom Watson, Lord Watson, of course, says he's passing the dossier related to this case to the Met, and he's asked for it to consider it and take further action. Is there something that could realistically happen, do you think? There have been, of course, plenty of attempts by the Met to look into this.
The Met are now in something of a spot here, because they are going to get large amounts of information passed to them from Tom Watson's lawyers and Prince Harry's lawyers, and they will have to carefully consider that. There is a general feeling that it might be something that the police decide or certainly the Crown Prosecution Service decide they're not going to pursue for all sorts of reasons. I think people feel that that's the criminal justice has had its go. I know a lot of people really want the police to investigate again. They want the CPS to consider charges that, you know, no one, no organisation should be above the law. And if the law was broken, no one should not have a free pass.
Many people have pointed to the deep pockets, of course, of those who have been able to take these cases on, and what this says about the access that broader society has to justice when it comes to these kind of civil cases. What would you say?
Civil justice is incredibly expensive and it is beyond the reach of most people. You know, a case like this, you need to instruct solicitors, you need to have counsel in court. The evidence is voluminous. It's just a very, very, very expensive business. And that's why the costs element is so critical in forcing settlements in these cases.
The BBC's former legal affairs correspondent now at Malton PR, Clive Coleman. Wars can be the catalyst for medical advances. The Second World War saw the mass production of penicillin, for example. But conflicts can also create conditions for the spread of bacteria that are resistant to drugs. And that's what's happening in Ukraine today, where hospitals are overcrowded and understaffed. The BBC's Abdujalil Abdurasulov has been to Kyiv and the city of Dnipro to find out how doctors are coping with these challenges.
In a spacious hall, two women wearing a wreath of flowers play the Ukrainian national instrument, the bandura. This is an initiation ceremony for young medics who recently joined the Mechnikov Hospital in Dnipro. To get new staff is a big relief for the hospital's administration. This facility, like most others across Ukraine, needs more people to deal with the biggest influx of patients since World War II. Dr. Volodymyr Dubina, the head of the intensive care unit at the Mechnikov Hospital, explains the threats they face.
When there is a massive influx, we will have a contamination with pathogens. When we have a contamination, it means we get hospital-acquired infections.
Dr. Dubina talks about antimicrobial resistance. That's when antibiotics and other medicine don't work. It's a global problem, but the war in Ukraine makes it much more challenging to contain its spread. Since the start of the Russian invasion, the number of beds in just one intensive care unit of the Mechnikov Hospital has tripled, while the number of staff has decreased. So maintaining sterile conditions has become much harder. And since evacuation of wounded soldiers involves several hospitals, dangerous pathogens spread even further. Today, more than 80% of patients admitted to a Feofania hospital in Kyiv have resistance to antibiotics. This is a recording of a surgery doctors did on one such patient, Private Oleksandr Bezverkhny, who was wounded a year ago. It's too shocking to describe his wounds, but treating his flesh ripped off by shrapnel would have been much easier had he not been infected with bacteria resistant to drugs. Because of this, Private Bezverkhny had sepsis 5 times. It's been so painful. I constantly called doctors at night, he says. Dr. Strokan, deputy chief physician at Feofania Hospital, says Oleksandr had more chances to die than live.
We've carried out more than 100 surgeries on him. And even at those stages, he got new infections. So what did we do? We did what every clinic should do. We isolated him.
But the Ukrainian hospitals seldom keep their critical patients in separate wards. Too many wounded and too little space. Patients mix and contaminate each other. To treat infections resistant to drugs, doctors prescribe antibiotics from what they call a reserve list. But the more they use them, the quicker the bacteria will adapt to those antibiotics. And when it happens, the reserved medication will become ineffective too. Dr. Strokan again.
We have to balance our scales. On the one hand, we must save the patient. On the other, we mustn't breed new microorganisms that will have resistance.
Зразу спитав, де донька, це пам'ятаю.
Private Bezverkhny is now going through rehabilitation. Doctors managed to cure his wounds. But as pathogens grow more resistant, the struggle to save other lives gets only harder.
And that was Abdujalil Abdurasulov reporting. Now, nicknames for professional footballers aren't often that inspired. Think Bex or Gazza. But one exception is a great Liverpool player from the 1970s, Steve Highway. He was that rarest of creatures, a top-flight player with a degree that earned him the nickname Bamba, after Bamba Gascoigne, the then presenter of University Challenge. Well, footballers have acquired the reputation for not being that clever, but actually a new academic study seems to contradict that theory. It says they are super clever with superior cognitive function. Leonardo Bonetti is a research fellow in psychiatry at Oxford University. He's the lead author of the study and joins us now from Italy. Good evening, Leonardo.
Good evening. Thank you for inviting me.
So tell us how you carried it out. These weren't IQ tests exactly, were they? But what you looked at 200 Brazilian and Swedish footballers.
Yes, exactly. We wanted to try to define a sort of ideal psychological profile of the elite football players. And we focused on the one hand on cognitive abilities and on the other hand on personality traits. And for cognitive abilities, as you mentioned, we really wanted to cover a sort of large set of tests. And we studied executive functions, memory, planning and abilities of solving logical problems.
And what did you find exactly?
We found that the football players, as you mentioned before, were characterized by very higher level of cognitive abilities compared to the controls. And that was true across essentially all of the tests that we used.
And what did you make of the results? What explains them, do you think?
Well, our interpretation and also the reason why we did the study is that we wanted to essentially see and check whether football was just about physical abilities and game-related abilities, or if there was something more about that. And it turned out that these psychological profiles seem to be key for being a good football players. And we expect that this is the case because, for instance, if you want to be good at making dribbles or the right pass at the right time or, shooting when you have to shoot, you need to have a very high level of cognitive abilities in order to make the right decisions at the right time.
Thanks, Leonardo. Let's bring in Five Lives' Adrian Charles, longtime football presenter, of course. Adrian, any surprise that footballers are actually super clever?
Absolutely no surprise whatsoever. If you give it any thought, just on every level, you see they just have to be special people. You know, if there's 1,000 kids taken on at the age of 9 by some football academy or other, you know, one of them might make it through, and they'll make it through. But they make it through extreme levels of focus and fitness, looking after their bodies and their minds. They've got to be able to take on a huge amount of information very quickly and make on-the-spot decisions all over the chaos of the football pitch. Now, look, they might not be able to, you know, give you the capital of Uruguay or tell you what the currency is in Chad or something, but you know, there's a fantastic level of intelligence exercised at high speed.
Where do you think the sort of cliche then about the thick footballer comes from? Is it because they kind of keep themselves a bit when they do the press conference? They don't want to give too much away. Is it sort of jealousy? People, you know, can't accept that you know, these young guys have got so much money.
I think all of the above. But also, I've got to say, I think there might be a slight class thing with football. With footballers, you don't get this with rugby players. You don't get these with cricketers because football is still basically young working class men and increasingly women. So I think that is part of it. This kind of looked down upon in some way and judged more harshly.
Just a quick word, final word, Leonardo. You did speak to women footballers and men footballers as well, didn't you? Any differences?
Well, not really. Actually, it turned out that for what we could test, at least, both males and females were characterized by very higher level of cognitive abilities. So there's no gender difference to our knowledge.
Well, it's good to know. So footballers very much in the clever class. And thanks very much for that to Adrian Charles and Leonardo Bonetti, research fellow in psychiatry at Oxford, who led that study into footballers. And that is The World Tonight. This is James Kamarasamy. For now, from me and from everyone on the programme, good night.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Board-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.